Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Welcome, nurses and hypochondriacs. I hope you're enjoying our Halloween episodes. And here we are with episode number 3. I'm having a lot of fun with it. And thanks for all your comments. Thank you for your ratings. Those of you that have been rating us. So much going on in the world. And I hope that this podcast can alleviate that, at least educate you while entertaining you and making you laugh. So hopefully it's doing that. What's going on in my world? Well, yes, I had several dates as usual. And one of my dates, he was very sweet. We did a few hiking adventures together. And then he invited me over to carve pumpkins and watch The Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown. And then he ghosted me. Yeah. So the great pumpkin and carvings of pumpkins didn't happen. But hey, that's Halloween for you. You get ghosted. To be expected. I just wanted to read before we jump into our guest today, who is phenomenal, and I can't wait to bring her on. I just want to go over some ghost stories. Hashtag hospital ghost stories. And I hope you enjoyed our last episode, which was episode 2. I see dead people. So this just confirms the I see dead people from the horse's mouth, from actual nurses and actual patients who have seen dead people. And thank you for our former guest, Only in the ICU, for sharing this hashtag and for putting it on. And she says that I could share with you. She couldn't come on the show today. She's a bit busy, but I will be reading a few ghost stories before we jump into our guests. So here's this one. One weekend, we had a patient on comfort care who was actively dying. It was getting close to, and despite calls to the family, she was in her room alone. Another nurse and I went in to turn her and make sure he was clean, etc. I was talking to her, holding her hand in it, and telling her it was okay to go. She passed within a few minutes. Time of death was 0249. The next night, the room was empty, and I heard an IV pump going off in that room. The same nurse came in with me as we were wondering what it was. The pump continued to beep, but when we walked in, the screen was black, and it stopped. It just happened to look at the clock. I just happened to look at the clock, and it was 0249. We thought of it as her way of saying thank you. Real creepy. Well, thank you. That was from Lauren on Twitter under the hashtag hospital ghost stories. I'll read one more. There's so many. If you guys want to go to this hashtag, it's a lot of fun. So I'll read one more. Our ortho floor had used to be a pediatric oncology floor. Elevators will randomly open and close, and patients will claim to hear a young boy running up and down the hall giggling. So we named him Georgie. Last week, Georgie wouldn't let me in my patient's room. Only when I said audibly, "Georgie, get out of the way. I need to see my patient," with the door open. I hate that floor. That's pretty interesting. And that's from Chelsea on Twitter under this hashtag hospital ghost stories. Anyway, hope you enjoyed that. And yeah, that happened to me. I did publish a story with a little hospital ghost, a little girl ghost that used to run around a hospital that I worked at. And she even would go to the McDonald's. And nurses would see her late at night or hear of her. And also the cleaning staff had lots of stories about her, which was fascinating. And I did write an article. I wrote a short story about her. It's called Our Little Hospital Ghost on scrubs.com, I believe. And if you Google it, it's there. It's on my website, roguenursemedia.com. So you could check it out. Again, give us a rating on iTunes and we would so love your support. Go ahead and follow us on Facebook, Nurses and Hypochondriacs. Go ahead and follow us on Twitter, Nurses and Hypocon. Instagram, Rogue Nurse Media. You could visit our website, www.roguenursemedia.com. And if you need any consulting or storytelling services, I will be launching several storytelling webinars and also branding webinars. On people have been asking me, how do you get CEs on your podcast? Well, guess what? I'm going to be having webinars and teaching you how to get them. Okay, so great. So just go to that website and the link will be on the podcast. And also, if you'd like to support us, you could go to our GoFundMe site, nursesandhypochondriacs.com. And also on our Venmo, nurses-hypo. And that link will be on at the end of the podcast. And like I said, we're a bootstrap grassroots thing going on here. So help us out and we could bring you much more entertaining content like we are today. And to continue on with our Halloween episode, I am so happy to bring on my next guest. And it's interesting, she probably wouldn't be here if the morgue had said yes to me, you know, because I reached out to the morgue, I sent them to an email, and I asked for someone to come on. And they told me they were too busy, the LA County Morgue, you know. I don't know, maybe it's their busy season, but whatever. But I got actually something much, much better for the audience. I'm so happy to bring on Mary Roach, and she is a New York Times bestselling author. She's published 7 books, and she is a specialist in scientific humor. So welcome, Mary.
Hey, thank you.
So I just want to start off by this whole thing on your writing process. Now, I am a writer myself. I teach writing. I have for many years followed several writers. I had a friend who is an editor for a small press in Berkeley. And I would go to a lot of his author readings and I would always ask them what their writing process is. And now your books, like the one that we're going to be talking about today, mostly is Stiff, going along with our Halloween episode. And that is The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. Now, how did you get to writing all this? How did you start with your writing process? Because I know you have a background in psychology, or you have a bachelor's in psychology, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have a, you know, liberal arts degree, a BA, and there really aren't a lot of jobs that really suits you for, really. There's not, what could I do? I could write papers and, well, you know, edit. So I, that was really the only job skills I had. So I started out editing and I was a terrible editor because I don't really care enough if like something's capitalized the same way in chapter 1 as it is in chapter 10 of a book. So I was a terrible copy editor because I just thought, no one will notice, who cares? So that's the wrong attitude for an editor. So I started freelance writing and I just started out at the very, very bottom doing, you know, press releases, not the bottom. I shouldn't say press releases at the bottom, but I started out just doing commercial work before I did any kind of journalism. I didn't have any background in journalism. Started writing for the local newspaper, and the San Francisco Chronicle had a Sunday magazine, and I would do freelance pieces for them. And then I kept doing more and more freelance writing, and I just found it fun. And I did some humor stuff, some, you know, couple columns along the way, and eventually wound up writing a book. So just one thing leading to another, you know.
But that's not just any book, Mary. And you wrote a book about corpses. You wrote a book about cadavers.
It didn't grow out of any kind of personal obsession or interest. I wasn't suckled by morticians. I'd never reported on that before. What happened is I was looking for ideas for this column I was writing for Salon.com, and I was in the basement of the medical school library at UCSF near where I live, and I saw this wall of books, old books called the STAP Car Crash Conference. Wow, there's an entire conference about car crashes. And I started looking through it, and it was back from, a lot of it was from the 60s when they were first starting to think about automotive safety and like how do we like make a crash test dummy. Like they needed to use cadavers to calibrate these dummies. So they were putting cadavers on crash sleds and things like that. So I wrote that column, reported column, and it got a lot of hits. And this agent I was talking to around that time had me look at which columns had the highest hit rates, which, you know, would be an indication that people found something interesting. So that was one of the columns that people seemed to be really interested in. So I thought, well, nobody's written a book about cadavers. Honest to God, as somebody trying to come up with a book idea, you feel like everything has been written about. I'm looking for something fresh.
No pun intended. Well, that one.
Something fresh and new and delightful. Cadavers was pretty much untouched terrain. People had written about forensics, but they hadn't really written about cadavers and research and practical uses of dead people. So it's kind of a book about interesting postmortem careers, you know, things that people have done while dead that have been useful or practical. So that was, so I wrote a book proposal, and that was how it all got started.
Yeah, I remember when the book came out in 2005, I was ending my schooling at UCLA for my grad school as a pediatric nurse practitioner. And it came out, and I was like, oh my gosh, this book looks so good. But for some reason, because of the cover and the picture, because it has 2 feet with the little tag, I was like, I don't know. I would pick it up, and I actually never read inside of it. And I was like, oh, I can't read it. You know, it just wasn't the time. And that was before I had ever taken writing classes and actually understood writing and appreciated writing. I mean, your writing, I will have to say, is very, very funny. I was reading the book. I started reading it this past Friday. I had bought my brother some hipster donuts. He'd made me some espresso coffee, and we sat in my mother's kitchen, and I was reading the book, and we were having these hipster donuts, and I was kind of telling him about the book. And then my friend called me, who's also a nurse practitioner, and I told him I was reading this book. He got very, very excited and started to tell me his story, which is what always happens whenever I tell people what the episode is or what, you know, we're doing here at Rogue Nurse Media and Nurses and Hypochondriacs. He started telling me the story when he was an ICU nurse and putting bodies in body bags as soon as they died, you know, as soon as his patients expired.
Yeah.
He would have to do that. And he's even taken one of my writing classes, and he just poetically, it's some type of trauma that he has that he can't forget about. And he just poetically writes about the smell, writes about the whole thing, and also the noise that bodies make. Now, starting in the beginning of your book, because your writing is so colorful, and I always teach, like, you need to show and not tell, and I think you show very, very well, which is hard to do. And you start in the book at a medical school for plastic surgeons when they've cut off the heads.
Yeah.
There's several severed heads, right? About 20.
Yeah.
In like in a pan that you would use for a chicken or roasting a turkey, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, because when you think about it, the human head is more or less the same size as a roaster chicken. And the thing with a severed head is that it may drip a little bit like a chicken that's cooking. So you want to put it in something. You want to put it in a container that would, you know, catch any drippings. So somebody at the, it was a Texas medical surgical seminar, training seminar for plastic and reconstructive surgeons. So whoever sets up those seminars had the brilliant idea to go over to Walmart or the drugstore or whatever, CVS, and pick up some disposable roasting pans. And they had set out on the tables and put the heads in the roasting pans. But you can imagine when you walk in, I mean, I've never been in a surgical training facility. First of all, you know, they cut the heads off. Of course they do, because it's easier to work with a head than a whole body. A whole body is heavy and floppy, and it takes a lot of people to move it around, whereas a head is, you know, you pick it up, it's like the size of a bowling ball, you put it on a table, it's a lot easier. It makes sense. But I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting whole cadavers. So, you know, I walked in and there are these, you know, heads with the bloody stumps. So it was surprise for me. I don't have a medical background, and this was one of the first places I went for the book. So, but it was funny because, they had done it so kind of nicely, you know, they had these lavender, disposable tablecloths on the tables and all the instruments laid out kind of, you know, in a way kind of like a wedding reception was going to happen, except for severed heads on the table. So it was this combination of kind of pretty and catered, but also like Halloween gory, horrible. So just kind of very surreal, a very unexpected and surreal scenario to walk into. And I got there before the surgeons had arrived. So it was just the heads on the tables with the lavender tablecloth.
Oh, gosh.
Whereas the woman said that the lavender is a soothing color. That's why they chose.
I remember reading that.
There's lavender. It was a really interesting afternoon.
I can imagine. And like I said, I was talking to my nurse practitioner friend, and I was telling him this part of the book. I was like, oh my gosh, I got to tell you this part that I just read about the heads. And he's like, oh yeah. He goes, you know what always got me in anatomy class is the smell. And I remember the same thing for me is the smell of formaldehyde.
Yes.
Now going through your book, it didn't seem like the smell bothered you as much. That's the first thing for me.
The heads were fresh. Mm-hmm. They weren't, which is actually the word that they use, I think. They weren't embalmed. They were fresh heads. It's possible they were frozen and thawed out, but I think they just...
Fresh resin.
Frozen and thawed. But anyway, they had not been embalmed because the embalming changes the, you know, kind of makes the tissue really hard and
rubbery, I think.
Rubbery, yeah. So the idea of this training seminar was to review some techniques and allow people to look at the nerve structure and vasculature and different parts of the face. So, you know, they wanted them to be realistic. So they didn't have a smell. They really didn't have a smell. I mean, I have been in a cadaver lab and, an anatomy lab where people were dissecting cadavers for gross anatomy. And that is a powerful.
That is a very powerful smell.
Toxic scent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like I said, going through your book, I was like, gosh, she doesn't talk about, you do talk about the smell in certain instances.
The body farm. I talked about smell.
Yes. The body farm, the body. And we'll get to that one. That is, and I can imagine it was very, fetid and putrid. So.
Yes. But, yes. That would be good words for it.
Right. But when I was in an anatomy class, and I remember it was just the smell. I mean, we had to dissect cats. We had a male cadaver and a female, and my anatomy teacher never wanted to bring out the female. He said she was gross, and he was utterly disgusted by her and would never bring her out. And I think,
why was she gross?
I never really saw her. He just didn't want to. He didn't even teach us.
Can you imagine though, like if you donate your body to science, you donate it for the, you know, for medical education, and then they don't use you because you're too gross.
Because you're too gross. That's, I think, terrible. Because she had been so cut up. I'm not exactly sure, but I remember him. He didn't even like to talk about the female anatomy. He barely skimmed over it. And I was so bummed because what I ended up going into is I really had a love for OB, obstetrics and gynecology. I wanted to be a midwife to begin with, and I ended up in pediatrics. So I was really, really upset and bummed, you know, but I just kind of let it go. He would talk a lot about peyote, so I don't know. I don't know. That
you
was an interesting
what?
Peyote.
Oh.
Peyote experiences.
Oh, listen. Interesting.
He was quite a character, I will have to say.
But the smell is so bad. I remember the lab that I was in, the anatomy class, somebody told me that halfway through they came into the lab and the legs were gone on their cadaver.
Oh my gosh.
They took the legs away just to reduce the exposure to the formaldehyde.
Wow.
Intense and toxic, I think, not good to be exposed to it. So they just, like, they came in one day, like, hey, something's missing. Oh, yes, the entire lower half of her body is gone.
Oh, my God.
They'd start at the bottom and work their way up. And then when they'd done the legs and the feet, they just got rid of the legs.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. I mean, there is no other worse smell than formaldehyde than just necrotizing flesh, like, yes, in necrotizing bacteria. Pseudomonas is the worst, I remember, from my days.
I have a friend who is the medical examiner for Alameda County, here where I live. She, every Friday, she comes in if somebody's been killed or, you know, there's unclear circumstances, she has to do an autopsy. And then I meet her for fish tacos. So she's like, if I have a body, I'll text you and we'll have lunch. So we're meeting outside, we get fish tacos and we sit outside and she'll tell me about who was on the slab. But she made it her point, because I said I've never gagged or thrown up around a body, including at the body farm. And so she would, unbeknownst to me, she made it her personal goal to make Mary Roach gag. So she said to me, oh, you need to come to the morgue today. I have an interesting case. So I show up and there were these two bodies. These two people who had been found in an apartment in summer, and they'd been there quite a while, and they were very, very big people.
Oh, wow.
Overweight and heavily decomposed. And when she cut, you know, the Y incision, cut the one of them open, and instantly gagged, had to leave the room. I didn't throw up, but it was unbelievable how bad it smelled.
And she was like, gotcha.
Like, in the body, she goes, it's not that bad. It's just like if you're changing a diaper. I'm like,
no,
not at all. It is so much worse than, I don't know what kind of diapers you've been changing.
Like, I don't know what kind of diapers that a toxicologist is changing, but, or the mortician, was she the toxicologist?
That was a pretty unforgettable bad smell.
Oh my God. I can just imagine. Now, we're talking about the farm. Talk about that experience, because I think that was
very interesting.
Yeah, the body farm, on how they took these corpses. It was in Tennessee.
Yeah.
They just laid them outside.
Yes, it's a, at least the time I was there, it's a 1-acre facility. It's right by the medical center in Knoxville. And it's actually a very pretty little piece of land with, like, hickory trees and lawn, and but it's fenced in. Like, you have to, you know, you can't just wander in. That'd be bad. So you go in, and at first it looks like, okay, there's a guy napping on the grass over there, but it's also very clear he's not napping, because there's something about dead people that there's a stillness to them that just seems instantly recognizably dead-like. So some of them were, at the time I was there, they were doing something about clothed versus naked and how does that affect the timeline of decomposition. So they were clothed, the ones that I saw. But you wander through and, like, then you'll come upon, you know, they kind of lay them out in different places depending on what they're studying. They're looking at different ways that the environment affects the speed of decomposition. So, like, you know, in the backseat of a car versus the trunk of a car, or in sand versus in mud, or dressed or naked, et cetera. So they're because it can make a huge difference in how long it takes the process to unfold. So that then could really affect the case. Like, you know, if you're trying to figure out how long has this body been dead, so you can figure out which day are we talking about, and then you can check out somebody's alibi or where somebody was. So you really need how long is this body? How long since this person was murdered? And it's very hard to tell without taking into account, like, humidity and temperature and moisture and all the environmental factors. So that's what they study. That's the research that they're doing. It's all forensics, crime forensics stuff. So it's fascinating. It's a really interesting place. I can only imagine if somebody, like, climbed the fence thinking, I'm going to go in and just, you know, drink a six pack and then, like, stumbling onto, like, 12 partly decomposed bodies. So, you know, they are very careful. I think there's like razor wire over the, you're definitely not an easy place to breathe.
And so was there the smell there? I mean, was it?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's outdoors, so that helped, right? I mean, it was August when I was there. And the other thing is that my clothes and the car that we were in, I was there with two other people, a researcher and then someone from the public affairs office. And we smelled so gross when we came out of there. We went to a restaurant and they like seated us outside. And I think that car, they probably just had to retire that car. Oh my God. And the boots, I wore this pair of boots. And I thought I had cleaned, you know, they were leather, old leather work boots. And I cleaned them and I cleaned the sole with Clorox. And
oh my gosh.
Like dogs would sniff my boots and like look at me like, you're a really interesting person. I really like you. I'm really interested in you. So like dogs would follow me around. I just got rid of them. I just threw away the boots. And it was because I really liked those boots.
Oh, wow. You had like human chunks of remains maybe on
when the bodies really get toward the end of the process, you know, there's kind of a puddle of liquids all around the body. So if you're walking around it, you're walking in this sort of liquid
goop
position fluid, and your shoes really take it up. Yeah.
Oh gosh. Like I said, with your writing, I felt like I was there. You know, but that just shows how good your writing is. I mean, I was there. Yeah, I was like, whoa.
It was a intense experience because there was the smell and there was also the visuals and there were a lot of maggots. And the researcher said, if you put your ear really close, you can hear the maggots feeding. So of course, okay. And I put my ear like right up to this body, and it's true, they kind of sound like Rice Krispies, kind of snap, crackle, pop. And then also because my head was so close, I had the smell really powerfully. I mean, it was just a triple whammy, you know, between the sight of these maggots under the top layer of the skin kind of squirming around and the smell and the sound. But it was, you know, it was so interesting because the guy I was with was describing the whole process and his project was really interesting. So it wasn't, you know, I was kind of distracted by what I was learning. I didn't feel grossed out or nauseous like I did in the morgue with my friend, the medical examiner. I never felt like, oh, this is disgusting. I need to leave the room.
Well, I think you put it in perspective in your book on how you saw it or how medical students see what they're doing is they see it as an object. They're not seeing it as a person.
Yes.
I think that's and like I said, I was reading that and it was almost like, I was like, wow, that's so interesting. I never heard anyone say that about the medical field. And it's pivotal for me because as a nurse, we are taught to see the body no matter what, even if it dies, as a whole body, as a spiritual being. You know? So the disciplines are so different that it's just like, for me, I am very lucky. I haven't been in situations where I've had too many patients die on me.
Yes.
There's only been a few, but I'm not the person I am uber empathic that I don't see people as objects, which has gotten me into trouble throughout the years, but that is not my thing. So I was thinking about this and I'm like, they should have the doctors put people in body bags and not the nurse. my conclusion. But this is, and I've been in nursing for over 20 years and I've taught and I've never, it hit me. I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. This is why everybody complains about physicians all the time, especially surgeons, that they cannot connect very well with their patients. Well, there's a reason for that. You know, it's like you're cutting up bodies all day long, you know?
And as a surgeon, a lot of them are specialists and you know, you really are working on a knee, you know, if you're, you know, say you're an orthopedic surgeon, you're kind of you know, the way they drape the patient and they only have the little, this little
area exposed, right.
Mm-hmm. They're working on. So, I mean, I can understand they don't want to be distracted. They just want to focus on the knee. So I could see why it would be easy to forget that the knee is attached to a person. And you know, there is that complaint with surgeons that they just come in, they get out the power equipment, they do their thing and they leave, and they don't really want to talk. You know, if the person comes back and says, I don't feel better, I don't think it worked. I mean, I have a friend who's just going through that now. You know, that's not what they signed on for.
Right.
I don't want to talk to you. You're a whole person. Go.
Yeah. On. Yeah, it's true. And that's why there's nurses in the OR. And one of their jobs is, I've had several friends and they've even told me situations where they've had to stop the doctor and go, remember, that's a person, you know, and either it's the music that they're playing that's inappropriate, the conversations that are going on, and I've heard of several instances where the nurses had to stop them, you know, and kind of bring them back to reality to what they were doing. So it was very fascinating. It just like I got that light bulb in my head when I read that. And like I said, I never saw it that way before in my whole entire career. Yeah. Like I always questioned it. I was like, I don't know. I don't, you know.
When it's a dead body that you're working on, I think that is one of the rare times where it's healthy to see it as just an object, because now it is.
Right.
You know, and one of the things about cadavers is that very viscerally, you just have this sense that like somebody's checked out, nobody's home, lights out. There's nothing animating that. That is a slab of meat. It's a very weird, very inescapable sense that you have, or that I had around a cadaver. I mean, I'm talking about not a person that you know and love, just an anonymous body. It really does not seem animated by a spirit. So it's appropriate to look upon it as an object.
As an object.
You can do useful things with. You could say, you could take organs, you could take tissue, you could save the lives of people who are still alive with this material. Because for that very fact, it is an object now, but it's weird because it still looks like a person.
Right. It's still hard. Like I had a friend who went to medical school in Guatemala and she's an anesthesiologist. And she said she would have to, back in the day, check out body parts. So she lived with other med students and they always had body parts in the fridge, like arms, legs, feet, whatever they were having to dissect and research or learn about. And she said, I think the most horrifying day was when she opened the fridge and she saw a fetus. And she said really did it for her. She didn't care about the hands. She didn't care about the feet. She didn't care about, but it was when she saw the fetus that it was very real. And at that point she said she was starting to think of not being in the medical profession. But it is horrifying just to open up your fridge.
One of the things that when I talk to people who worked in the automotive safety world, they said it's very difficult to design. You know, you want to design car seats that are safe, and you want to be able to test them. But it's so hard to say to a parent who's lost a small child or a baby, could we use this body for medical research? You just can't go there with somebody, a parent who's lost a small child. So there's a tremendous need for pediatric cadavers, but you know, nobody wants to go there.
Because
it's such, I mean, to lose a child is such a...
To lose a child is just...
So,
you know,
so
there are no words.
Right. So it's been very hard to do that work for automotive car seats, seat belts, et cetera, making sure they're safe for children. That has been a difficult process.
That comes to a story early on in my career. I think I was about 24, 25 years old. And I didn't know how to deal with death. You know, I really hadn't had people close to me die. I had grandparents, but they died in other countries and my parents weren't very close to them. So I never really had that experience, a couple coffins here and there. But I remember, you know, because I was the youngest one on the unit, I worked on an ortho neuro med surge unit at the time. And we would get their overflow of OBGYN maternity patients. And so of people who had stillborns and miscarriages, so which was incredibly sad. So I had a patient one day who had a full-term stillborn. And the baby was in the morgue in the freezer. And I remember the nurse telling me, now remember, the charger, she's like, you got to go get the baby. And I was like, what do I do with it? Like, I was working with adults at that time. I was like, what am I supposed to do? She wants to see the baby. You need to go get the baby. And I was like, but they're like, you have to defrost it first. I was like, I have to what?
It was in the freezer?
Yes, it was in the morgue. It was in the freezer. Yeah, the baby, you know, so I had to bring it out. Put it in the microwave. I had to wait and thaw the baby out for a little bit so it got a little bit warm.
Yeah, right.
To room temperature. And I believe it was a male, and it was just, it had only been deceased for a few hours. So I went and I changed it, put some clothes on, and I wrapped it in a baby blanket to make it look as real as possible. But I mean, the baby had, you could tell something was not right with the baby because it was dead. The soul was gone. But I had taken it to the mom, and it was the saddest thing ever. And the dad I had gone to high school with, but we weren't like close friends, so that was even more awkward. So it was very awkward. And I think I left the baby there for like several hours and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so then the charger was like, you got to go pick the baby up.
Yeah, because
I hate to laugh, but it was just, this is how you got to go get the baby again and go stick it back in the morgue. She can't keep it there. It's going to decompose.
It's going to start to smell. Yeah. Oh gosh.
So I was like, okay. So I had to go, and it was so hard. I mean, they were just sitting there with the baby, and I was just like,
oh wow.
You know, but and so it was, I mean, cause the baby's.
Yeah, but it was probably really, beautiful. Really.
It was very, very sad.
But it was probably really good for them to see it.
Yeah. I mean, it was nice. They spent some time and stuff like that. And but I want it. Yeah.
You dressed it and made it look as good as possible. You know?
Yeah, but that was the thing.
That's the only image that they'll carry that image with them forever.
Right. And I was just so young, and I didn't understand. Now I know so much, and I've really studied so much more, and it would have been a very different experience, and I would be able to be stronger to counsel them. But I was just like, I don't know what to do.
No.
Well, we didn't cover this in Nursing 101. Sorry. Yeah,
you know. Here's your baby.
Here's your baby. Sorry. I don't know. Super, super difficult situation.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the beating heart cadavers. The cadavers that were there, I think those are very fascinating, you know.
They are really interesting, yeah. They're very heroic. I mean, a beating heart cadaver is it's somebody who is brain dead, and that is the legal definition of dead in our society. So these are dead people, but they're on a respirator. I mean, a machine is breathing for them. So all of their tissue, their organs are being oxygenated, and their heart is beating. And so everything is working except their brain. They're dead. Their brain dead. So very often these are people who were in car crashes, and, you know, bad blow to the head. So these people, because, you know, you can keep them, their bodies going via this, you know, machine, the respirator, you can then take all, you can basically bring them into the operating room like a surgical patient and remove organs for transplantation. So I went to an organ harvest, I guess they used to call them the organ harvest, which has kind of a lovely autumnal ring to it.
And that's what you wrote in your book. Yes, I love that.
So they, so this gurney comes along the hall, down the hall, and this person looks like a live patient. And if you touch them, they're warm. You can see the heartbeat on the monitor, but they're dead. They're legally dead. So it's very strange. You're just not used to I don't know, dead bodies that I'd seen up until that point look very dead. Everything there, you just look at them and you know they're dead. So a beating heart cadaver really feels and looks much more like a live person. So it's a very trippy thing. But it was very moving because this person, this woman, went on to, her organs went to 3 different patients.
Wow.
More or less saving their lives, which is this amazing when you think about it. When as a live person, you don't really get a chance usually to save 3 lives. Well, you know, you might, people in the medical profession might, not so much. So it's kind of incredible that as a dead entity, you could do this amazing thing. So yeah, it is fascinating. And people are a little confused about the difference between organ donation and donating your body to science. You know, organ donation, not everybody can do that because the organs need to be kept oxygenated. So it's usually motorcycle or car crash victims, you know, people who have this massive head trauma, but the rest of, you know, but they can keep them alive, keep their bodies going. So the organs can then be kept alive right up to the point where they're taken out of the body and then, you know, taken by airplane or helicopter to, you know, the person who needs them as quickly as possible. It just buys you time. Whereas if somebody die, you know, usually you die and you go to the morgue and, you know, you start to decompose. And those are not organs that you want to be transplanting. Although, right. I guess you can take, you know, there's a small window of time where you could.
Yeah, I think each organ has a certain amount of time until there's cell death that happen to where they can't use it. So that's why there's such a rush to get these organs to the people. I have a friend who has 2 lungs that he got transplanted from one person, which he's phenomenal. I mean, he fights every day for his life. And, I forgot how many years now that he's had these lungs, but it's pretty interesting. It's pretty amazing. But it was a very controversial, like the legal community was like, no, this is not
it was in the early 60s, I think, where the legal system decided upon the definition of death. The legal definition was brain death. But up until that point, people associated it with the stopping of the heart. So in the first cases, there were people accusing the surgeon of murder, saying, you know,
wow,
by stopping the heart and taking the heart out, you have killed this person. You know, because there wasn't the brain death definition. And there was some murder case where, there was a murder, and this was in California somewhere.
Yeah.
And the person who did the murder was saying, I didn't kill this person. You, the surgeon.
The surgeon killed him. Yeah. I read that.
The heart, you killed him. I did not.
Oh my God. So
it came down to a legal definition of death. And I at the time, that definition was very new, or it hadn't been established. But anyway, they were, I don't know, I don't remember the details of the case, but that was what the actual murderer's defense was based on, the fact that it was the surgeon, you know, that when he stopped the heart, that was what was had killed the person.
That's totally insane.
Yeah.
What I found also interesting in that section of the book, you talk about cellular memory, like transplanting an organ into someone else, if they have any memory of that other person. Yeah. And I believe there's no real evidence that shows that.
No, I mean, there's a lot.
I mean, even Dr. Oz said it wasn't true, right?
Dr. Oz was Dr. Oz. That was in 2001 or 2002, when I interviewed Dr. Oz, he was just a heart transplant surgeon. He was a doctor. He really was a very different individual. It was so weird. You know, now he's very kind of controversial in the stuff that he's promoting. But back then, he was a transplant surgeon. It was so bizarre. Anyway, there's often, or not often, but it's not uncommon that people, when they get someone else's heart, say, they start noticing like, oh, I like a different kind of music now, or I enjoy something I didn't used to enjoy, and I think I got a part of this person's personality. So someone, it wasn't Dr. Oz, somebody did a study where they actually looked at people's impressions of their donor, which was anonymous, and then they went back and looked to see if it was accurate, like if it matched their impression of the person and their personality. And there really wasn't any evidence for that, but that's, you know, it's one study, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, but the Jehovah's Witnesses believe in that. Like, that's one of the reasons why they do not accept other people's blood, because they feel that they're getting that person's soul essence and they're losing a part of their soul. Yeah. That's the whole thing where they're like, I do not accept someone else's blood. So who knows? I find it very, very fascinating always, though.
Well, I don't know a lot about this, but I think there was, in the early days of transfusions, there was like white people didn't want to get blood from people of another race. You know, there was also this whole kind of racism built into transfusions, and like, just the sense of, you know, that you'd be getting an inferior product or some crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting. So going into decapitation head transplants, which I read a book, and it was a fiction book. It was called Noggin. the author's name is John Corey, and I believe he wrote it in 2014, 2015 is when I read it. And it talks about this kid who had cancer. They saved his head. They froze it. And
this is fiction, right?
This is fiction, yes. And they, you know, severed his head, got rid of his body, found, you know, finally there was a body 5 years later, and they transplanted his head. And I think he was the first head transplant, and they transplanted him on I believe it was a skater dude. It's been a while since I read this book. It was an interesting concept.
Yes.
But they've actually done experiments, right?
Yes. In 1970, I think it was, Dr. Robert White in Cleveland it's essentially, instead of taking a few organs, everything's failing, rather than giving them a new heart, lung, liver, you give them a whole new body.
Right.
So the patient is actually the head. Technically, it's a whole body transplant. Well, you could head transplant, but the head, the donor is giving an entire body, and the recipient is having his head attached to that body. And Dr. White actually did this with rhesus monkeys.
Yes.
And they lived not very long and not very happily. They did live. I mean, this was before immunosuppressive drug regimens were very good, so you'd have a lot of rejection issues, and also you still can't attach the spinal cord, the spinal nerves. So the person, if you could keep them alive with connecting up the arteries and the veins, you could keep the head supplied with blood. The person could not get up; they couldn't move. They'd be paralyzed from the neck down. So it's not a very practical. Even if you could do it, you're not suddenly getting the body of a skater dude, or you would get it around. You just lie in a bed. Like, look at my...
Oh my God, what kind of a life is that now?
Body that I can't move.
Right.
But there are surgeons. There's a surgeon in Italy and another, I think, in China, maybe, who are saying that they're going to do it. The guy in Italy... Caravaggio or something like that. He's been saying that he's going to do it, and that he has a patient who wants to do it. he's he hasn't done it, and it's been a while. So I think he did a little bit more publicity stunt than anything at this point, but he's saying we could do it. We could, he's claiming you could regrow the spinal nerves. That I really doubt that. That seems wrong, but
I don't know.
I don't have a medical degree, but anyway.
It seems very Isle of Dr. Monroe, the Island of Dr. Moreau. Do you remember that movie? I think it was in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
Where that's what he was doing. It was like decapitating people and putting splicing them on animals or vice versa.
Yeah, or like even, didn't they do that in that movie, Get Out?
Get Out. I think Get Out was more, it was like more of a hypnosis type thing, kind of.
I can't remember. But they were putting them personality. Maybe they're just putting the personality into.
Yeah. Do you think it was more like that?
That's it. It wasn't a head thing, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, if you Dr. White showed that it is possible to hook up the blood supply, so you could. But you know, I don't even know that he had the esophagus hooked up, or I mean, I think it was very rudimentary. It was just like a blood supply to the brain and to the, you know, the flesh. And that was kind of it.
Yeah, it was like a modern day Frankenstein type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the immune immune system would have rejected the body. So you know, it was certainly an interesting experiment, but not a very nice one considering for the primates that were involved.
Oh, I can totally imagine. So I'm going to ask my editor engineer. I told you he was a big fan of yours. He said he grew up reading your column. He's read all of your books. So this is what he told me. I'm actually, because I told him to come on, he has to work today. He's also, what does he do again? Gosh, I just got a blank. So he's at work today. Okay, so he said a couple of times, I have all her books. She at one time was a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, so I kind of grew up reading her stuff. He's a geologist, that's what he does. Uh-huh. The thing about Stiff that always sticks out in my mind are the little caps that they put in eyes when they are prepping someone for a funeral have little hooks that keep the eyelids closed. Just the creepiest thing. So, yes.
I have one of those. It's not here. I'll show you. I have one. It looks like, it's kind of like a nightmare contact lens. It's like a little, like it'd be a big contact lens, and it's got there. You know what they are? They're chads. Remember the hanging chads on the voter ballots? Like poked through thing that's only partly poked through, and it works on the same principle as those spikes at the rental car lot. You know, and they say, do not back up, severe tire damage. Like you can go over them one way, but you can't back up because it will poke into your tire. Well, the same thing with this eye cap. You could pull the eyelid down and then it catches on those little barbs, those little perforations, so the eye won't go back up. And it's just a little tiny, it's like the size of a big contact lens and it's plastic and it just catches the eyelid and keeps it closed, which is useful if you're an undertaker.
And what I found interesting about that section of your book was where they had to sew the anus shut in case there was any leakage of fluid, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of details that you don't really think about at a funeral. Yeah, they've got close them, then they have to sew the jaw too. They'll do that as well to keep the mouth closed. I think there are probably different ways to do it, but when I went to the San Francisco Mortuary College, I guess it was. It's closed now, but I saw the students sort of going through a whole process, and they did they closed the mouth that way. Yeah.
Very fascinating. So just to wrap it up, you went all the way to China looking for human dumplings that were made.
Yes. I love that kind of wild goose chase. I saw something that was a Reuters story, and Reuters at the time was a little, you know, not the highest journalistic standards. But anyway, it was this article from Hainan, China, and it said there were these two brothers, and one had a restaurant and one had a crematorium. And claimed that the guy at the crematorium would cut off the buttocks and give them to his brother who ran the restaurant, who would make them into a dumpling, a stuffing for a dumpling. And Hainan is an island. It's a pretty small island. And I thought, well, how many crematoria could there be? So I went there and I found a translator and I showed up at the crematorium and had the translator ask, is this the crematorium where you guys were handing over the buttocks? And this woman got furious, as well she might, you know. I don't know what I expected, but she denied everything. And then there was I found out there was a second crematorium, and I called them, and the person there said, you can't come and talk to us, and we'll sue you. She was threatening to sue you for I don't know what. If you say anything, we'll sue you. So,
so it must have been the one.
I don't know, you know, I didn't get anybody confessing, but I still, to this day, don't know if there's any truth to that.
Did you go to the dumpling place?
No, I didn't, because there was no restaurant by that name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there wasn't enough detail. And the article didn't say the name of the crematorium either. So my guess is that some Reuters stringer was bored to write up a story and make some money.
Fake news.
Yeah. I don't know.
You never know how much, yeah.
It was an interesting afternoon, yeah.
I can only imagine. You're just like, hey, by the way, I'm looking for.
Yeah, and the poor translator, because I didn't really tell her exactly what we were doing, and she thought that I was working for a mortuary magazine or something. And then we got there, and I said, Sandy, I have to tell you, this is what we're going to be asking about. And she's like, okay. And so she just launches into this thing, and then I see the director getting more and more angry and you know, lashing out at my translator, and then the translator turning to me and going, yes, well, the director is very angry. The director thinks this is a horrible story.
That reminds me of my first ever journalistic writing piece. I was trying to get promo for my storytelling show, Nurses and Hypochondriacs, in 2015, and I reached out and pitched to a nursing magazine, and the editor reached back and said, why don't you write me a piece on haunted hospitals? Because I sent her a little ghost story that I had written, and I was like, okay. Sure. And to me, I knew nothing about journalistic writing. I mean, I had taken several writing classes and stuff, and all I knew was from what I saw in the movies that you had to go to the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
So I went to the Linda Vista Hospital in Boyle Heights here in Los Angeles. And it's no longer, it's known as the most haunted hospital in America, in Los Angeles. And, there's lots of theories. People used to use it as a movie set for many, many years. ER yeah. was shot there. So it's very famous.
Yeah.
And I just went there and I was just walking around seeing what I felt. And it's been restored to a, not a skilled living facility, but a, I forget. But anyway, it's been restored to this living facility, and a senior yeah. living facility. And, so I was there and I remember asking, you know, the security guard, it had been his first day and he saw me lurking around. He's like, hey, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, well, and he was only 21 years old. And so we just started chatting.
Yeah.
And then I started asking him questions and he was telling me the stories and everything. And I go, is it haunted, do you think? He's like, well, the people who live here say they can smell the scent of burning flesh because it used to be a crematorium as well. So I was like, oh, that's a good one. Yeah. So, but very, very fun. Yeah. So, and just to put in here about going back to the eating and the flesh part, I liked where you wrote about the honey people, the people doused in honey. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
The mellified man. Yeah.
Yes. And
that's a medicine I don't ever want to take.
No, that they would give this man honey and he would poop out honey and then he would die.
It's an ancient thing, and who knows if it really, I mean, it's in the Materia Medica, which is sort of an ancient medical text, and they would eat honey and nothing else. And then when they died, they would be steeped in honey and soaked in honey and put in a stone sarcophagus and sealed for like 100 years. And then they'd open it up and the contents they would use as a medicine. They called it mellified man.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, honey itself has antibacterial quality.
Oh, yeah. I prescribe honey to a lot of my patients who are having,
if you have like an infection that won't go away, or, I mean,
it's great for allergies, to get honey, local honey. It works. It's awesome. I
don't know that you really need the decomposed guy.
No, not the decomposed man. Just the regular local one is perfect.
They believe it. So I think it was an ancient, it was a Middle Eastern thing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It was like an Arab type thing.
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah.
You make a lot of confections with honey. So
yeah. Yeah. Why not a person? Sure. Why not a person? So would you donate your body to science still? I know you wrote in the end of the book about that journey that you went on, that maybe donating your body, which I thought was interesting.
I would, I'm kind of undecided. I mean, I do like the idea of it, and I think it's a good thing to do. I like the idea of something useful and helpful being done with my stuff, but I also do like the idea of a cremation, something kind of clean about that, and scattering the cremains. This is kind of a nice tradition.
So, I like that too.
I don't know. I feel like because I wrote that book, I really should donate my body. And I believe it.
I mean, you're dedicated.
If all the people, if I don't do it, how could I expect anybody else to? So I feel some obligation to do it, but I also do just like the idea of a simple cremation.
I agree. I definitely agree. Well, Mary, are you having any appearances lately? Any new books coming out? Anything new that you're working on that you would like to promote?
No. Right at the moment, I am working on a book, but it's too soon to be really saying anything about it. And so I don't have anything coming out. I'm just working on, just plugging away at the next one.
Excellent. Great job. Well, it was a pleasure having you on. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Thanks, nurses and hypochondriacs. Bye-bye.